Okay, yeah, you know, is there something here special in this illustration?
Earlier we had talked about the progression from 4 to the S4 and S4B stages. I think in context it's well to point out the technical progression from the S4 to the S4B. And that's what this chart really shows. We really learn practically all of the key technological steps in the S4. The insulation, the common dome, the structural features were all basic to the S4. The S4 was more complicated by having 6 RL-10 engines instead of the single J2. But that was a very fine engine, worked quite well for us. And I would say that the experience that we gained on the S4 program was very important to us in being able to carry off the S4B program with the efficiency that I believe we did. In a sense, the S4B is a more simple configuration, although it has greater demands on it. So one of the things we learned as we progressed from S4 to S4B was to simplify things, make things more likely to work, more effective, and we ended up with a very efficient stage. In fact, when later on when we were pressed to think in terms of how to reduce costs, make the stage for less money, it became very difficult to find really basic techniques of configuration adjustment that would lead to a lesser cost stage. I think that is a tribute to the efficiency of the design.
So we heard someplace or somebody mentioned that the S4B was really a much different flight article because of the engines maybe, or because of the feed lines, etc., because of its diameter. Do you really see it that way?
You're trying to say that the 4 is to the S4 as the S4B is to the S4. Just a different vehicle.
I don't really feel that way about it. Although I can see why a person could take that position. The geometry is different on the S4B than the S4. But the basic design principles are essentially the same. And by that, let me be specific. Common bulkhead, internal insulation, structural concepts, valve actuation devices, pressurization systems were essentially the same. So I consider them to be quite similar in nature, and that the S4 was the technical precursor to the S4B and directly applicable. Now, packaging was different, but that's a minor thing.
The RL-10s came out of the Centaur program, didn't they?
Yes. It's a fine little engine.
The J2 gave you a higher specific impulse.
Well, yes, but mostly the large thrust that was involved and a much more efficient packaging, a single engine versus 6 or more small engines. So it was a much more efficient device.
Was that J, single J2 on the S4B, is that gimbaled, or is that a straight shot?
Yes, it's gimbaled. Pitch and yaw. Roll control is handled by the auxiliary propulsion systems that are attached to the skirts.
Did you have any particular difficulties in achieving interfaces with the, let's say, the S2 stage and the RU unit?
Oh, no. That was straight, very straightforward. As a matter of fact, that was one of the simplest jobs we had. This chart sort of goes back to the main theme we've been talking about, which compares Thor to S4 and to S4B. And it notes that we launched our first Thor in September 1957. And the first launch on S4B was January 64, which is a considerable time period. First launch of S4B was February 66, only 2 years after the first launch of the S4. And the first launch of the Saturn V version of the S4B was November 1967. The common theme that goes through all of these stages, of course, is the liquid oxygen technology and the type of engine, although changing from oxygen kerosene to oxygen hydrogen, the fundamentals are essentially the same. Liquid hydrogen being introduced in 1964 was the big step which led to the insulation and some structural adjustments to accommodate the very cold liquid hydrogen. And the pressurization system, which we introduced with cold helium internal to the liquid hydrogen tank as a concept of improving the efficiency and packaging, if you will, of the helium, which is the pressurant for running the valves and actuating the pneumatic systems.
This helium pressurization was kind of a new thing.
Yes, that's right. This enables you to put very, very cold helium gas in the liquid hydrogen tank and keep it cold so that as you draw on that gas, you then permit it to expand by warming up to the ambient conditions that exist, which permits a very efficient packaging and storage capability of the helium.
Was that anything like that used on the Centaur? Now they used a pump for the propellant utilization, didn't they?
I think that's correct. Yeah. I do not know that Centaur uses cold helium as we do. Yeah. But that was a very clever approach and a very logical one.
Oh yeah, these are the various.
This particular slide shows the types of joints, types of fittings and stringers and tank walls that we have developed. Well, this is very fascinating to a structural engineer. I'm not sure how fascinating it is to others. But it really presents a picture of a rather efficient design concept that has led to a good rugged design that has not given us any problems.
Now, on the skirt sections here, the stringers are external.
Yes, that's right.
And on the S2, there's some external stringers too, and we got the impression from them that they finally included that insulation with a cork material around the outside of those. aerodynamic heating. Now, do you have any problems with this or what?
Well, there's some aerodynamic heating, and we do coat these stringers with heat protection devices such as Chlorotherm, which is a thick paste type of paint, which permits the heat that is generated during exit to be contained so that we don't increase the temperature of the stringers to the point where they lose their strength.
It's contained in the paint base.
Yes, paint is a becomes a thermal barrier in the same fashion as the insulation inside of the liquid hydrogen tank, although it's working in the other extreme.
Yeah. What's this stuff, Chlorotherm?
Chlorotherm, K-O-R-O.
Mm-hmm.
And therm, thermal.
Chlorotherm.
No, it's just a thick paint, almost paste-like in nature, which applies quite readily to these structural devices.
Well, is it just simpler to build a skirt with these external strings rather than put them on the inside?
Oh, yes.
Because I remember thinking that, that flash riveting has been around for quite a while.
Well, we don't need that. See, these stringers are all pretty much within a very thick boundary layer. So drag-wise, we're not contributing much drag.
Okay, yeah,
the design parameter is not drag, it's simply structural strength with lightness and then the efficiency and ease of construction. So it became more economical to put the simple half stringers on the outside, and the only design criteria that had to be met then was to provide the thermal protection during the brief moments of high heating during exit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that always kind of bothered me, I guess, because we heard so much about even the structural was getting out of the atmosphere pretty fast, these aerodynamic features and qualities, and it kind of bothered me to see these
structures out there. To have a smooth surface as you would on the wing of a transport. Now the reason for that is fairly simple. The amount of time that we are within the high drag atmosphere is reasonably short.
Mm-hmm.
Now if we were flying for literally hours like a DC-8 or a DC-10, then that drag experienced over a long period of time would be quite meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And would and of course is the reason why we have gone to laminar flow type of wings and smooth, very smooth skin surfaces on the wetted areas of transport airplanes, because that has a tremendous payoff in fuel consumption.
Mm-hmm.
It is not that sort of a thing on the short period of time that we're going through the atmosphere on something like a Saturn V. It just is not necessary to one of those techniques.
Looking at it from this picture in mind, again, of the Skylab configuration and the Apollo Applications Program, when you were designing, the S-4B, were you kind of thinking of the Skylab at the same time? Were there any inputs that came in design because of a possible Skylab configuration?
Oh yes, as early as
In 1964,
we began to think in terms of the use of the liquid hydrogen tank as a work area or experiment area or activity area
one of the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
When something like the Saturn 1B was in Earth orbit. And the point there was that the S4B does remain in orbit for a considerable period of time, weeks, months, year, depending on what the orbital altitude is selected. So the device is up there. It is a huge thing. Being, feet in diameter, and the hydrogen tank is probably some 30 to 40 feet in length, if you include the dome. Mm-hmm. So we had a large opening at the top of the hydrogen dome for manufacturing reasons, and where there came an occasion in 1964, and I guess actually in the latter part of 1963, when we had occasion to increase the diameter of that opening at the top of the hydrogen tank for ease of manufacturing and better welding characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was size to permit workmen to enter or exit. And we got with Dr. Von Braun and agreed on a diameter for that new opening that would match an astronaut and his gear going through. And we said, now if at any time we want to use the spent S4B stage as an activity area, it will be easy for us to permit ready access of the astronauts to the liquid hydrogen tank.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the original concept was that extravehicular activities could be performed in the confines of this tank without anybody being worried about drifting off and being lost in outer space, such as would be the case if tether-ups departed for any reason during some of these spacewalks. There were some experiments being contemplated of maneuvering units, maneuvering aids, little handles employing jet gases that would assist astronauts in moving around in extravehicular activity. These could all have been tested inside the liquid hydrogen tank. From that concept in 1963-64, gradually developed the concept of the Skylab as we know it now.
Yeah, I see now, because I remember seeing some other things about using just this empty tank, and I couldn't figure out really, it didn't come through me what you would be doing in there, just to test these EVA things.
And we did all sorts of EVA type of activity in pressurized suits in that tank and not be concerned with being injured or being left in space. Then it became pretty clear that we could also repressurize that tank and think in terms of living in a short sleeve environment. And the original concept of the orbital workshop was to use a spent liquid hydrogen tank.
So the thing was, from the start, though, originally designed purely as a rocket. It was, you got into design ways and realized you could do some things.
An opportunity for other uses. Since it was up there and represented a very considerable resource moving around in orbit, the question was, let's get smart and see how much use we can put to it.
Even before we get off of that, now, were there certain times, too, when you designed this thing, sheer logistical problems closed certain avenues till you realized that you couldn't carry it down a highway or under a bridge or maybe carry it in a certain mode, and so you had to redesign it somehow.
No. It helped us select the location of this facility.
Okay.
Quite seriously.
Well, someplace I read that it was in the trade journal, however, that the S4 was something that they began to think of logistics and as a parameter of its original design.
Yes.
There was mostly in the location of the plant.
The wheeler pikers, if you will, compared to the S2 and the S1C, so we felt we could solve our problems quite readily, but it did. In thinking in terms of future programs, the logistics consideration did have an important influence on the location of this facility. Mm-hmm. We are close to Seal Beach as a port and close to a naval air station as a means of getting air transportation. Those two things had to be considered in the location of this facility.
Mm-hmm.
They had some bearing on the location of Seal Beach facility for North America,
mm-hmm.
for the same reasons.
Yes, keep me going with the...
Well, I have some photographs here of the several tankage and membrane joints. We can look a little bit more at the common bulkhead and how it is, the simplicity of its attachment to the liquid oxygen tank and the attachment to the liquid hydrogen tank. Now, I think the important thing that this chart shows is that the structural simplicity that came out of the design concepts is impressive. These are not difficult welds. They lend themselves to easy inspection,
mm-hmm.
and good quality control. The most complex part of this thing is the fitting of the aluminum surfaces to the fiberglass common bulkhead. And that is probably the most difficult job we have, and perhaps the most demanding one as far as workmanship is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, well, considered at one time to be the big worrisome feature of the design, in fact, in practice, has turned out to be most routine, and after the first few articles were manufactured, that settled down into a very routine process and has been of no trouble whatsoever.
Well, you had some special processes, didn't you, to shape the common bulkhead for this?
Well, that's a very elaborate process, and I would prefer to get an expert on that to discuss that with you whenever you're ready to talk about that. But that has reduced itself to a very clever methodology of fitting the and sizing the fiberglass center section so that it matches very precisely to the two aluminum domes and lends itself to good adhesive characteristics and excellent quality control. I'm very pleased with the outcome of that.
Again, on some of these welds, were these fairly common as far as aircraft construction? Or they were kind of unique for the space program, but they were less straightforward?
They were really unique due to the application. It had not been common to use weldments of this nature for major structural joints in aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
The joints were all riveted or bolted. And here we had a situation where we departed from that and were depending entirely upon the integrity of the welds for both structural attachment and for sealing. We can not have any leakers, if you will. Leakers being paths for molecules of hydrogen to pass through, not boiling leaks. You don't have to have anything but a path of migration of molecules of hydrogen into the common bulkhead to mix with molecules of oxygen from the liquid oxygen tank to have a very distasteful situation in the common bulkhead.
Was the inert gas welding technique used anywhere in the aircraft industry?
Oh, yes, yes.
That was fairly common.
Yes, the main reason for that is that you just can't stand to have just common atmospheric gases around the arc. They tend to, oxygen and hydrogen, or the hydrogen, I guess, is the worst offender,
mm-hmm.
tends to embrittle the welds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you had some more.
Yes. I think the most impressive part of the portion of the program was the design of the welding fixtures. What I have here are some of the large welding devices that were used to do these precision welds.
Yes,
in this case, we're welding a liquid oxygen tank to what I take to be the liquid oxygen tank. This is the dome of the liquid oxygen tank. This is the cylindrical section of the liquid hydrogen tank.
And they're inside the tank here.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so this would be coming down through that top opening you spoke
That's
of.
That's correct.
And there
are being travels now automatically and is doing the circumferential weld of the cylinder to the liquid oxygen tank extension.
This whole beam coming down here, these two supports coming in, forms kind of a triangle.
That's right.
Rotates all around the inside of the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this is the problem through the shop area, but of course nothing was going on. All we saw were the fixtures, and sometimes we didn't have a very clear idea of how they operated.
Well, for a two-man operation, that's pretty good.
Now, does this work on a geared track under some time? The men are there
yes.
to observe it or guide it?
They are controlling the feeds, and one of them is watching the welding process.
Mm-hmm.
This is our Sacramento test facility where we did the acceptance firings
mm-hmm.
on these two stands, beta stands, we call them. This is a facility that we and NASA developed for the conduct of the S-4 and the S-4B activities. This is now, for all practical purposes, closed down.
Mm-hmm. Beta 1 and Beta 2 test stands?
Beta 3.
Beta 1 and Beta
3? We're going to be Beta 1, Beta 2, and Beta 3, but we only made Beta 1 and Beta 3. I think we skipped Beta 2 for some reason.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm right on that.
Well, now in the test program, there were a couple of explosions, weren't there?
There was one on the S-4 program, and there was one on the S-4B program.
Excuse me here, I'm going to